From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. Donald Trump will enter the White House with an unprecedented global business empire alongside the power of the Oval Office. He says he's handing control of the business off to his children, and that's that. Is that good enough? And what if it's not? This hour on Point, money, family, and the power of the presidency under Donald Trump, the conflict of interest challenge. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. If Country X does a huge deal with Trump, Inc., are they buying the favor of the White House, his business, while president? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Later this hour, we will look at President-elect Trump's assertion without evidence over the weekend that millions of votes were fraudulent in the vote that elected him. But first, the conflict of interest challenge. Joining me now from Washington is Eric Lipton, Washington-based correspondent for The New York Times. He's been all over this issue. Eric Lipton, welcome to On Point.
Thanks for having me.
And with us today from London is Timothy O'Brien, executive editor of Bloomberg View, the opinion arm of Bloomberg News, author of Trump Nation. Tim O'Brien, welcome. Thank you for joining us today.
Hi, Tom.
It's great to have you both here. Eric Lipton and Tim O'Brien, let me just first get your big take on this. Has there ever been, Eric, a president in the White House with the business interests on the scale of Donald Trump's?
No.
And
never.
And so is there a clear path for negotiating this?
It's unclear, and it's something that he's going to have to make some decisions about. And at a minimum, it looks as if it's going to be a major distraction throughout his administration if he decides to just continue to allow his children to manage the company's operations, because there will be regularly situations in which reporters will be forced to raise the question as to whether or not he or his family are potentially benefiting from an arrangement that, or if he's taking a different action involving a particular foreign government because of his financial connections to that country.
Timothy O'Brien, you're in London today. How about the rest of the world and how they will look at this? Are there precedents for world leaders having such vast business interests alongside their global power, in this case, the power of the United States?
Probably the most direct comparison would be Silvio Berlusconi in Italy. And it's sort of funny because I think two or three years ago, people would have said, oh, my God, Italy, a Berlusconi could never happen in the United States. And now, lo and behold, you have Donald Trump as president. You know, we've been covering his conflicts at Bloomberg since May or June earlier in the year. And I think one of the things that's really important to remember about all this is that he doesn't really have vast real estate holdings and he doesn't have a business empire. And it would be relatively straightforward to corral it from a conflicts of interest standpoint. And I think that's been lost in some of the coverage. He essentially runs a licensing machine. He gets fees for putting his name on other people's buildings, other people's products, and he's done it for years, whether it's mattresses and men's underwear or vodka and real estate. And if he wanted to, and if the Trump children wanted to, they could appoint a third party who oversees all of the licensing operations for the Trump organization, which would eat up a big portion of that part of the business. And those agreements could simply be struck without any involvement from children of the Trump, children or Trump. The larger issue, though, that will continue to hang over this, as Eric points out, is that he's going to touch so many things as president that conflicts will inevitably arise, if not week to week, day to day. He's about to renegotiate a contract with a major Chinese bank for a lease in Trump Tower. Trump himself is a developer. He relies on loans from major banks, including Deutsche Bank in Germany, as well as a major Chinese bank. How can he not be involved in those things without conflicts arising over banking regulation and his own financial interests? And they're going to collide.
Eric, no business empire. I mean, it's described as a business empire all over the place. I get Tim's point is that a lot of it is putting his name on developments, real estate developments, hotels, and more that are going up around the world. Whether you call it an empire or not, you've done reporting on many, many locations abroad where there are potential conflicts. Give us a little sense of the map of the world and the Trump brand, Eric, where the flashpoints might be.
Well, they get involved in these projects for hotels and business office buildings and residential buildings at often at an early stage. And so all of the permits have not necessarily been issued. So the brand name is associated with that project as it's going through the permitting process, such as in Argentina, for example. And so he also, while he doesn't have an ownership stake, as we understand it, it's likely a combination of a fee for the name and also some form of commission based on the sales. So he has a direct interest in how successful the project is. And so I think that, you know, then, therefore, when the government in that country is reviewing the application for land use approval or for whatever other permits are needed, there may be an incentive for that government official to accelerate the review and to give the approval as a way to essentially send a message to the White House that we are your friend and you should be our friend. And that's, to me, is one of the biggest problems. It's not that the Trump family is going to do anything itself that's inappropriate, but that others are going to offer them special consideration that brings them benefits and that they'd have no control over, but that it seems as if that creates an inappropriate arrangement.
Tim, I mean, it may work out well for a company that's built on branding, and now the man at the heart of that brand is President of the United States. That's not a low-profile situation. So it may work out well and in a way that raises all kinds of ethical issues on the business front. But what about for the United States? How would this hurt the United States if these conflicts of interest emerge? How could you go from, oh, the deal gets waved through more easily to, wait, that cost America something, maybe something important.
Right. I think what's at stake here, too, is the prestige and the credibility of the office of the president and the White House. We elect people as public servants, ideally, to be president, who enact and pursue policies that are meant to be in the public interest of the United States and to promote our interests overseas. If any of that gets either corrupted or derailed by one individual's financial interests, that's obviously problematic. But there's also a prestige and a credibility that also would get eroded as part of the office. And in the past, Trump's predecessors in the White House have been well aware of this. And that's why historically, although presidents aren't subject to federal conflict of interest laws, and they've released their tax returns to be as transparent as possible with the public and voters about what their financial interests are and what possible collisions might arise. As we know, Trump refused to release his taxes throughout the presidential campaign, and his team says that's not going to change while he's in the White House. The other thing that presidents have used is to put all their financial and business holdings into a blind trust. Trump has clearly shown that he has no interest in using a blind trust as practically and commonly conceived. He says that by giving control of his business to his children, that would effectively be a blind trust, which of course it's not. So the two options to him that are available on the face of it, he's choosing not to pursue, and that goes beyond just his, the problems that raises goes beyond just his financial interests. It goes into the, as you brought up, Tom, the credibility and the majesty of the office he's going to inhabit.
Eric, is it just about credibility and majesty? Those are important things. Credibility is important. I mean, where could this turn into a policy conflict where there's this decision before the president that might hurt his own business interest or might help his business interest? Does it come down to something as clear as that?
I mean, I can think of two examples, one very general and one specific. So the general issue is that the United States for the last several decades has been pushing other governments, particularly in the developing world, to create a greater separation between the political power and economic power, and so that there's greater transparency, there's less likelihood of money being passed for government deals, for contracts or for permits, and so that has been the United States has been the champion of that, and the problem now is if you now have a president who has all kinds of financial interests that create a blurry line between where the government ends and the financial interest of the president begin, then it really undermines several decades worth of intense pressure by both Democrat and Republican presidents to encourage countries like India or the former Soviet republics and to really do a better job of making their economies transparent. The second, more specific thing is, let's look at the Philippines, for example. Okay, so here you have the Trump Manila Tower is just being finished. His partner, business partner there, is already discussing possible future additional projects. His son is in business with the son of his business partner in the Philippines as well. And this guy who is his Philippines business partner is the envoy to the United States for the Philippines. He was just named that by the president of the Philippines. And the problem in that situation is, here you have the president of the Philippines is having quite a battle with the United States right now over whether or not he's engaged in human rights violations by killing drug dealers before they get jury trials or before they're even charged with crimes. And he thinks that's a good thing to wipe out crime, but the United States says it's a human rights violation. What does President Trump do when he's presented with his State Department folks who say, we really need to stand up against the Philippines, but his business partner is the envoy from the Philippines? Will Trump be as aggressive as the Obama administration has been on that? That's unclear. And how much, even in his head, will the fact that he's got a building there and other projects pending, or at least his family does, how much will that affect his decision? We don't know, but it creates at least the appearance of a potential conflict of interest.
Eric, do we know who holds Donald Trump's debt, perhaps abroad?
Much of it we don't know. We know some of it. His financial disclosure report had, I think, $300 to $500 million disclosed. But Tim, you may know more about this, but there's certainly a lot more debt than that. And it is not all disclosed. The financial disclosure report requires his assets to be disclosed. Some of the debt is there, but not all of the debt that he's involved with. So we don't know all of his business partners or the names of all of his business partners, which is another problem. We don't even know where there are conflicts in certain cases because we don't know who all of his business partners are. We don't know who he owes money to. So, it goes on from what we know something, but there's more there that we don't know.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking this hour about Donald Trump's conflict of interest challenges. He's got the White House coming now. He's got business in this country and around the world. Different business profile, much more of it than we've seen in a president before, and much less distance being described between him and that business. You can join us this hour. Are you comfortable having the Trump children run the Trump business empire while Dad is in the Oval Office? Do you feel that the country's interests and the Trump's interests may get confused, that deals and decisions will get made for the Trump bottom line, not America's? Do you not care, not worry? If not, why not? Eric Lipton is with us from the New York Times. He's been covering this all over the place. You can link to his reporting at our website, onpointradio.org. And Timothy O'Brien is here, executive editor of Bloomberg View, Bloomberg Gadfly, author of Trump Nation, with us today from London. Richard Painter joins us in just a moment, but let's listen first to, this is Donald Trump Jr. talking with ABC's George Stephanopoulos in September and saying his father would cut ties to his business on winning the presidency and cede control to his children, putting the business in a blind trust, he said.
But a blind trust, it's not a blind trust if it's being run by his children.
It is, because he'll have nothing to do with it, George. He said that. He wants nothing to do with it. He wants to fix this country. He wants to get the country on the right track again.
So there will be a wall between you 100%. And your siblings and your father?
We won't talk to him about it. It's in the grand scheme of things, it's a big company, but it's small potatoes compared to what he
but
wants to do.
But he's still going
he
to
He doesn't
know.
Need the money. He doesn't need any of those things. What he wants to do is he wants to fix America.
He's still going to know what the businesses are,
no,
where
won't.
They are.
We will
How
not
could
discuss
he not know
this.
That?
We're not going to discuss those things. It doesn't matter. Trust me, as you know, it's a very full-time job. He doesn't need to worry about the business. The business is in good hands. He trusts us with that.
Trust us. Trust me, says Donald Trump Jr. there. Eric Lipton, Tim O'Brien, please stand by. Richard Painter joins us right now from St. Paul, Minnesota. Professor of corporate law at University of Minnesota. Former chief ethics lawyer in the White House for President George W. Bush. Richard Painter, thank you very much for being with us today.
Well, thank you.
We've heard you speak critically against the backdrop of your own experience as an ethics advisor in the White House, speak critically of the arrangements that have been described by the Trump family for handling this potential conflict of interest. Do you see anything emerging in these recent days that gives you more comfort with the planned distance or lack thereof?
No, I do not. I recall that we even pushed back against the idea of having the name George W. Bush go on a public school until he had left office. The notion of putting the president's name in a building We felt incompatible with the office of the presidency, much less the president or his family receiving money for that. And I think that is completely incompatible with the office of being president. If you could have your name put up in a building and have money sent to you or your family for doing that. And I know that he has a brand as a real estate developer, and that is what his name has been associated with. And he had a choice here. If he wanted to continue to be a real estate developer and sell his name to be put up buildings, that's fine. But he wants to be president of the United States. He won the election, and now it is time for him to be a responsible president and not to be receiving money from all over the world simply for putting his name up in a building. That, for a public servant, is going to be viewed as a payoff. And that is just not right. And I think that they need to put a stop to that part of the business now.
But that's the major part of their business. Are you suggesting that they just more or less shut the business down or a major portion of it?
I do not think that that is compatible with the office of the president. No, we don't put Obama up. I mean, there are other famous names in this country other than Trump, and we could put Bush or Obama up in a building and rake in the cash. I mean, many presidents could have done that, but they don't. And I know that he has been doing this before as a real estate developer, but he has chosen to be president of the United States. The American people have chosen him, and now it is time for him to do that job. And yes, to stop receiving money for his name. And there's also a national security interest here. We put the name Trump up on a building in a country with a terrorism threat. Well, who's going to pay to defend that building? Is it going to be a foreign government? And that raises a question of gifts to the Trump Organization from foreign governments. Is it going to be the United States taxpayer? Is it going to be the Trump Organization? Or is there going to be a complete failure to deal with the issue of security, and some tragedy happens because the Trump name is put up on a building in a place where there is a threat of terrorism?
Professor Painter, Mr. Trump said last week, he told the New York Times editors that he conceded that his brand has been made hotter by winning the election. But he told the editors there the president can't have a conflict of interest under the law. Mr. Painter, Professor Painter.
No, he's wrong on that. Of course the president can have a conflict of interest. There's a particular statute that does not apply to the president, and that is the criminal conflict of interest statute that prohibits certain official actions by a government employee. It applies to everybody else in the executive branch, and it would criminalize certain actions which enhance your financial well-being if you are an executive branch employee, but does not apply to the president or the vice president. But just because we do not choose to criminalize certain official actions of the president and vice president does not mean that the president does not have a conflict of interest. The president is not above the law. The founders never wanted the president to be above the law. That's very clear from the writings of the founders at the time. The president is expected to conduct himself in a matter consistent with the public interest. And as I say, once again, that money being paid in to the president from people all over the world simply for putting his name on a building is a situation that it invites corruption. And that is not acceptable for anyone holding public office, much less the president of the United States.
Eric Lipton, you're there in Washington. I know we have to let you go in a minute. What about the Congress here? Under the Emoluments Clause of the Constitution, and we'll look at that, they have some oversight role here. There's been legislation proposed. What would it suggest, and how are people, representatives, lining up on that front? Are Republicans, Democrats? Does it have a chance of passing legislation that might affect Donald Trump's business oversight or a wall between the White House and business under Trump?
So far, what we have is a bunch of letters written by mostly, almost entirely Democrats in both the House and the Senate, urging there to be a review as to whether or not any of these, you know, the appearance of conflicts are real, are in fact real conflicts, and if there should be any action by the Office of Government Ethics, which oversees the executive branch, or some other entity in the government to do something. But, you know, all you have right now is Democrats who are out of power in both the House and the Senate writing letters. They don't have enough votes to create investigatory committees. They don't have the subpoena power unless they have a committee with, you know, the support of Republicans. it's, you know, you have Justin Amash, that, you know, one Michigan Republican who tweeted saying that Trump needs to deal with this. But for the most part, Republicans in Congress have been largely silent on this. So it's unclear at this moment as to whether or not Republicans are going to agree to create any committees to examine it. I, in fact, think it's unlikely. Why would they do that? It wouldn't be in their political interest to open up a Pandora's box of having a committee with subpoena power, you know, the equivalent of the Benghazi committee. So if that's the case, then the Democrats can write as many letters as they want, but there's not going to be a formal investigation of the matter.
We had the Republican Congressman Justin Amash, as you say, Michigan, saying if you have contracts with foreign governments, it's certainly a big deal, too. He said, hashtag drain the swamp. Is there anything then other, beyond the Trump family assertions to us, Eric, that is or likely could build a bigger wall?
I mean, Richard Painter can address this question, but one of the things that I've heard asked is whether or not, if someone were to try to bring litigation based on the Emoluments Clause, whether or not they would even, in fact, have standing to do so in the court, and it would perhaps require an act by, you know, an action by Congress, and that perhaps an individual who wanted to, say, sue Trump to say he was violating the Constitution would get that case would get thrown out. Richard, I don't know, is that correct?
I think it could be. It's an issue that could possibly arise in collateral litigation between other parties, for example, a private party in the United States and a foreign government, and the allegation that that foreign government was engaged in making payments to the president that violated the Emoluments Clause. So the ways the issue could perhaps get backdoored into other litigation, but I doubt that a private party would have standing to sue the President of the United States for being in violation of the Emoluments Clause. The enforcement of this is really up to Congress, and that was the intent of the founders through the Impeachment Clause. And this is a very serious issue. This is not just some obscure part of the Constitution. It basically says no payoffs from foreign governments. And the founders were very concerned about this. And this is the same reason that we did not want someone who's not a natural-born citizen becoming president of the United States. And I'm amazed, after all this fuss about birth certificates, when there was no evidence whatsoever with respect to President Obama's being a natural-born citizen, that now we have this issue, which was a very serious one of concern to the founders, and that it's not being addressed. And yes, the enforcement here is with the House of Representatives if a violation of the Emoluments Clause is serious enough.
Eric Clifton with the New York Times. I know we have to let you go. We're very grateful to you for being with us today. Keep the reporting up, and thanks for joining us, Eric.
Thank you so much.
Let's go to our callers. Tim O'Brien, please stand by. Richard Painter, Robert's calling from Ashfield, Massachusetts. Robert, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. My main concern is right here at home and how his personal investments are going to affect his decision. I'm referring particularly to the Dakota Access Pipeline. Right now, Native Americans are under siege again in a very warlike fashion by local authorities that are really attacking them for their peaceful demonstration.
Is Trump an investor in that pipeline? Is that what you're getting at, Robert, or what?
As what I understand, he has $500,000 to $1 million invested in the parent company of that pipeline. And that's a personal investment. And that means he has a personal interest in seeing that it goes through. And that seems to be a huge conflict of interest.
I don't know the facts of that, but let's see if we do. Tim O'Brien, are you aware? I don't know that particular investment. Do you, Tim?
I don't know enough detail about that one to talk about it, Tom.
But here we are.
I think the issue it raises, however, and his, you know, his presidency will raise, is that the current conflict of interest structure around the presidency needs an overhaul. I don't think releasing taxes should be a discretionary matter. I think going forward, every president should be required by law to release their taxes. Or, you know, a campaigner, certainly, as well as the president, to release their taxes. That's currently discretionary, and Trump's ignored it. And then I think, per Richard's thoughts, we have to have very clear guidelines about disposal of assets and other financial interests prior to occupying the Oval Office. And that's left too much currently to the president's own discretion. And Trump has clearly said he has no real concern about conflicts. His children say, trust us, but we really shouldn't have to rely on the most powerful office in the land depending on the kindness of strangers, essentially, and in a trust me kind of doctrine. We've run into problems with that around corruption historically before, and we will again if that's the only standard.
We're looking at the conflict of interest challenge that comes with a Trump presidency. Richard Painter, there at the University of Minnesota, you were chief ethics lawyer for George W. Bush. Do we need new law around this? Or, I mean, for decades, seems like forever, this managed to take care of itself. Prior presidents, maybe, they didn't have holdings on the scale of Donald Trump's, I guess, maybe not since very early on, if ever. But did they require tougher law in order to push them into resolving this more cleanly?
No. Every president in recent memory has avoided significant financial conflicts of interest, even though the criminal conflict of interest statute does not apply to the president. And the reason for this is that there is a political mechanism there to enforce anti-corruption standards vis-a-vis the president and the vice president. And that is the impeachment mechanism set forth in the Constitution. If the House of Representatives believes that the president is corrupt, the president will be impeached. He need not violate the criminal conflict of interest statute that does not apply to him in order to be impeached. And that is a constitutional crisis that is awaiting any president who goes into the Oval Office with the attitude that the law does not apply to me, because the law does apply. It's just a different enforcement mechanism.
But if Republicans are already unwilling to look at legislation that might make these lines clearer right now, what makes you think they might move toward impeachment at some hypothetical point in the future?
Well, they do not need the legislation. The point is that the House of Representatives has the discretion to deal with these situations with respect to the president and the vice president as they come up. And I can assure you the Republicans are not going to want to go into the 2018 elections, much less the 2020 elections, carrying the president's baggage for him with respect to financial conflicts of interest. I mean, they're not getting money for putting their names up on buildings back in their district. And at a certain point, the members of the House and the Senate are going to get fed up with this and send the message to the president it's unacceptable. And impeachment is not the only answer. I mean, they could make it clear that they're not going to work with him with respect to legislation or nominations or other matters, that it's not going to be a cooperative relationship if they are going to suffer politically for the president's conflicts of interest. The president needs to address this in order to be an effective president. So my point is we don't need a criminal statute. We don't need more laws. We have political mechanisms in place. And if the president, if President-elect Trump wants to be an effective president, and indeed if he wants to remain president, I think he's going to deal with this.
We had the Wall Street Journal in an editorial saying, you know, make this cleaner and clearer and get out of this bind. But we also had a columnist there saying we ought to admit it was all this was part of the bargain when voters elected Mr. Trump in full view of his business interests. His business interests are how voters know him. Holman Jenkins wrote in the Wall Street Journal, Professor Painter, as if to say, look, this is part of the bargain that voters struck.
Go ahead, Richard.
Yeah, I don't think voters voted for Donald Trump for a whole range of different reasons. I don't think they thought through, well, gee, what is he going to do with his business interests once he becomes president? Voters who support him, I believe, assumed that he would handle that responsibly.
Tim?
Well, I do. The problem here is disclosure again. I don't think voters had any grasp of the full extent of his business dealings or his business history. I think had they had more of that, they might have thought twice about some of this. I think some of it voters didn't care about, but I think we need to return to this issue of disclosure.
Support for On Point and the following message come from Goldman Sachs. Get insights from some of the world's leading thinkers on markets, industries, and the global economy in the firm's podcast, Exchanges at Goldman Sachs. You'll hear discussions on topics with far-reaching implications like climate change, autonomous driving, the future of China's economic growth, plus much more. That's Exchanges at Goldman Sachs, available on iTunes, Stitcher, SoundCloud, and Google Play, and at gs.com/podcast.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Donald Trump's conflict of interest challenge as he heads toward the White House with a very substantial business interest in this country and around the world. He says his children will run his business. This is unprecedented in scale and arrangement in American history, as far as I can see here. Mr. Trump, though, known to have these interests as he headed for the White House and saying, look, the president, he says, can't have a conflict of interest under the law, and I'm not going to be swayed by those business interests. How does that look to you? With Richard Painter, he was chief ethics lawyer for George W. Bush in the White House, now professor of law at the University of Minnesota. Timothy O'Brien is with us, executive editor of Bloomberg View and Bloomberg Gadfly, author of Trump Nation, joining us today from London. Here was Mr. Trump talking about his business with Fox and Friends. This was in September. Host Brian Kilmeade asked what would happen to Trump's businesses if he won the presidency.
If you win, will you and your family permanently sever any connections to the Trump organizations while you're in office?
Well, I will sever connections, and I'll have my children and my executives run the company, and I won't discuss it with them. It's just so unimportant compared to what we're doing about making America great again. I just wouldn't care. Now, I guess you could say there's a conflict because as the country gets stronger, that's good for all companies, right? But I wouldn't care. It's so unimportant compared to what I'm doing right now.
Donald Trump saying he's got his eye on bigger fish to fry than his own business interests here. Don't worry about it. It's small potatoes by comparison. Last week, his senior advisor Kellyanne Conway talked with NPR about the whole situation.
It's a very unusual situation to have a president-elect that is such a successful businessman and has so many holdings. But as you know, and as your listeners know, his adult children are already very involved in the success and the execution at the highest levels of his business holdings, and that will continue.
No problem here. Move along. Eric Lipton has been with us, Timothy O'Brien with us now, and Richard Painter. Lots of callers. Christy in Charleston, South Carolina. Christy, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Yes, hi. Thank you. I think he's kind of clearly shown that the only ceiling to his business behavior, either in the White House or outside, is not honor or duty bound, you know, none of that. So the only thing that's going to keep him in check is regulation. I mean, he's shown that clearly in the way he used tax law in his businesses and what he's saying now about there is no conflict of interest because I am president. He's just going to push to the extreme extent. It's up to Congress to do something about it. We can hope that, you know, they're going to be duty-bound and want to be reelected in a couple years. But there's got to be something we can do to shoot a cannon across the bow here to increase the pressure sooner than later. And my questions are, at what point can, you know, what can we do now to actually increase this expediency of this and increase the pressure on Congress besides just calling your representative?
Yeah, let's pick it up. Richard Painter, is there something that might be done now to raise the pressure on this front?
Well, yes. I think the members of the House and the Senate need to be actively engaged in discussion with the transition team about what we're going to be doing going forward. Because at this point, there's complete chaos in this area. For example, the children, we were told we're going to be running the business. Well, all I've seen thus far is the children helping run the transition effort and being very much involved in picking people who are going to serve the president in the White House.
Sitting in on meetings with foreign leaders, the Prime Minister of Japan, for example.
Yes. And so which is it? I mean, we're being given conflicting stories with respect to the role of the children. And this is where I think that the members of the House and the Senate need to sit down, with the transition team members and some perhaps with the president-elect himself and say, look, we need to work together to have an effective government, a government free of conflict of interest. And this does mean the Trump business empire selling off some assets, perhaps doing a public offering with respect to the real estate holdings, and yes, not leasing out the president's name to be put on a building in return for cash payments to the president or his family. We just don't do that. And the fact that the president has been doing that before he took office is irrelevant. That is not acceptable. And we could have payments coming in from foreign governments in violation of the Monuments Clause. We could have all sorts of problems. And I think that needs to be made very clear, that if we're going to work together to have an effective government, we cannot accept these conflicts of interest. The president is not above the law. That's a point that members of Congress made to President Washington in 1789. And it's a point that's had to be made from time to time again. We made it to President Nixon, and I hope that we can have a much more pleasant experience with President Trump.
Greg in Louisville, Kentucky. Greg, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Yes, sir. I'd like to make a couple of quick points. Yeah. First, I keep hearing about the president's name on a building. If you follow that logic, then President Obama should have immediately withdrawn his book with his picture from circulation. You know, because a person had business before, we don't want to turn them into a pauper in order to gain the White House.
Yeah.
And secondly, I don't see a big difference between having the Trump Organization or saying the president owned a lot of Apple stock. Suddenly, if he was dealing favorably with Ireland, would that be perceived as him trying to enrich himself through Apple? So holding a multinational stock is really quite the same thing. And you know, the idea that, well, the Trump name needs to be removed. Like I said, Mr. Obama would need to pull his book out of circulation to satisfy your other comments.
Greg, let us pick it up. Richard Painter, I'll come first to you on that, on President Obama's autobiography.
That is a book that he would receive the royalties when hundreds of thousands of people pay, what, $25 or whatever it is for a book, $30. I don't know what the price of the book is. And these are hundreds of thousands of people making that decision. That is very different than one organization or company paying millions of dollars to put the name Trump on a building.
Well, for example, maybe in China, where the Trump Organization is reportedly now looking at putting up many new hotels, and really government owns all the control of land there, i.e. The power to grant that or not.
Well, and the really, you know, the direct thing here, Tom, is the Clinton Foundation. Quite appropriately, people were concerned about the Clinton Foundation being a cauldron of potential conflicts of interest, and as it was, and that scrutiny was deserved. This isn't an ideological or partisan issue. This is about good government, it's about honesty, and it's about financial clarity. And one of the problems looming over all of this is if we're going to rely on Congress to take action either through an impeachment or just an open questioning of his business ties, there needs to be greater disclosure to start with, because Trump doesn't oversee a publicly traded company. There's nothing forcing him to do public disclosures in the same way that a public company would. It's all private transactions. All of it can be handled quite easily in very private settings. And it could well be that a large and a troublingly large portion of this stuff would just be hidden from public view. And his relationship with the children goes beyond, his own biological children. He's talked about his son-in-law, Jared Kushner, having a senior role in the White House in the same breath that he's talking about keeping his business distant from the White House by having his children run it. But, of course, Jared Kushner is married to his daughter, Ivanka. And if Kushner is privy to White House policy, I find it a little hard to accept the notion that none of that would get back to his wife or to the other children running the business holdings.
Richard Painter, we've just got another minute here, but who would oversee this? Who would investigate it? If there's concern about conflict of interest, who would uncover it?
Well, it depends on what type of conflict of interest. I've been very concerned that someone working for the Trump Organization or perhaps someone in the government could start having discussions of both U.S. government business side by side with Trump Organization business. The issue that came up when there's a communication with a member of the European Parliament, and the question is, well, what about my windmills? Or what about those windmills near my golf course? Well, if there's any of that and it goes too far, someone could be accused of soliciting a bribe on behalf of the President of the United States. That would be a very bad situation, which could lead to criminal investigation. And then there are a range of other types of conflicts of interest, which can only be addressed by the House of Representatives if it thought they were serious enough to warrant impeachment. But I hope that these things are addressed informally through discussions between the president-elect and his transition team, the members of Congress, so we can resolve these problems before anything gets out of hand.
We will watch this space before and after the inauguration. Richard Painter, former chief ethics lawyer in the White House for Republican President George W. Bush, thank you very much for being with us.
Well, thank you.
And Timothy O'Brien, executive editor of Bloomberg View. Tim O'Brien in London, thank you for joining us today.
Thanks, Tom.
In a moment, we'll look at Donald Trump's assertion of fraud in the presidential election. This is On Point. On Sunday, Donald Trump claimed that millions of people voted illegally in the presidential election earlier this month. He tweeted that he, not Hillary Clinton, would have won the popular vote had millions of illegal immigrants, quoting there, not voted. The president-elect offered no evidence to back his claim, baseless claim, apparently. Separately, three swing states are gearing up for a recount, three states that gave Donald Trump his margin of victory. Joining me now to talk through all of this is Philip Bump. He is a reporter for The Washington Post covering politics. Philip Bump, welcome to On Point.
Thank you very much.
So the president tweets that there were, 2.5 million fraudulent votes cast in the election. Is there any evidence? What is the base for that claim?
Sure. So there's broadly speaking, there's no evidence that there was any rampant in-person voter fraud. Just as there is almost never any evidence that there is any substantial in-person voter fraud. He seems, however, to be seizing upon a claim that got some traction earlier this month, including at the conspiracy hawking site InfoWars, that was made by a guy on Twitter who essentially said that he worked for an organization that had evidence that 3 million people who were not citizens voted in the election. He offered absolutely no evidence to back that up, but it was still picked up by InfoWars and then by the Drudge Report as potentially being accurate. That seems to be the basis for the claim. Again, absolutely no evidence that it actually happened.
Is there any evidence from earlier surveys of American presidential elections that fraud on that scale is anywhere in the system at all?
Well, one of the things people love to point to, for example, the 1960 election and what happened in Illinois. You know, obviously there were longstanding rumors of what happened, you know, Chicago and dead people voting, so on and so forth. That was more than 50 years ago. In recent elections, there is no evidence that there are substantial efforts to commit in-person voter fraud. There are often examples of people, for example, registering people who shouldn't be and are arrested for voter registration fraud, but not evidence that those fraudulent registrations are then used to actually vote. It simply is something that has been lifted up in recent years in part to reinforce Republican efforts to move forward voter ID laws, but there's simply no evidence that this happens on any big scale nationally or even in state and local elections.
Is there precedent for a president-elect calling the legitimacy of a vote into such questions so publicly with a specific and unevidenced assertion, allegation?
No, I mean, absolutely not. I mean, it's very unusual. I mean, I think the most likely precedent that we have is actually after the Iowa caucus, which Ted Cruz won surprisingly, and Donald Trump accepted it that night, but then a couple of days later started accusing Ted Cruz of having stolen the vote. That was when he started calling him Lion Ted and so on and so forth. So it certainly is Donald Trump himself has made these claims before, these allegations. He said something similar after 2012, in fact, on Mitt Romney's loss. But it is not normal. It's hard to stress that enough for someone, particularly someone who won an election, to try and raise questions about what happened. I think it's pretty clear that what's happening is he feels somewhat slighted that he didn't win the popular vote. And so he's trying to undermine the fact that Hillary Clinton won the popular vote by, at this point, more than 2 million votes. And this seems to be his effort to do that.
He may be uncomfortable with that outcome, but that stands. What about the recount that's been organized by the Green Party and the Democrats now throwing some support to it in a number of states? Is that likely to change the outcome of the popular vote, or for that matter, could it touch the Electoral College vote?
I think it's very unlikely to change either. It's almost certainly not going to change the popular vote simply because Hillary Clinton's massive lead in the popular vote, I shouldn't say massive, but largely in the popular vote, is largely a function of California, which isn't being looked at this point. It's unlikely to change the electoral vote as well, because there certainly are rumors that are out there among supporters of Hillary Clinton that somehow the results in these states that also were surprises, Wisconsin, Michigan, Pennsylvania, that maybe something untoward happened. There's no strong evidence that anything untoward happened. And I think that Jill Stein of the Green Party, her effort to keep a recount here is partly opportunistic on her part. But really, it seems as though the Clinton team is signing on in part to tamp down some of the rumors that have been spreading out there about, you know, what may have happened in these states. But it's unlikely anything's going to change.
You say Hillary Clinton's massive lead in the popular vote. What about that? Is this a historically large margin, the 2.2 million at this point votes by which she exceeded Donald Trump in the popular vote?
Well, it certainly is for a losing candidate, right? I mean, we saw in 2000 that Al Gore won the popular vote but lost the electoral college. But that was a much closer contest. It is a function of the fact that Hillary Clinton was able to build up very big margins in very large states, whereas Donald Trump eked out narrower margins in the states that made a difference, right? So like those Midwestern states, essentially at this point it came down to a little over 100,000 votes in three states that are why Donald Trump won the Electoral College, even though Hillary Clinton won California, which is 12% of the country, by about 4 million votes and counting. So it's sort of an imbalance in how the popular vote works against the electoral vote, and it set up a very unique situation.
Is there any more credibility to the Clinton camp questions about the states they lost than there is to Donald Trump's assertion in the tweet over the weekend?
Well, I think the difference is that the Clinton camp acknowledges that they're unlikely to actually see any change, and that there isn't any robust evidence that anything went wrong. You know, part of it is that Clinton supporters have been calling for augmenting the vote for weeks now. Clinton supporters certainly are much more likely to believe that something happened than the Clinton camp has actually expressed. So I think that's a key distinction, that Clinton herself, A, hasn't said anything unlike Donald Trump, but B, they acknowledge that this is not something that's likely to actually uncover anything or change the result.
Philip Bump covers politics for The Washington Post with us today from New York City. Thank you very much, Philip.
Thank you.
Listeners, thanks for joining us today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.